Hi there, boys and girls. Things at Shindig 2013 are really heating up now that so many bands have been
eliminated.
Be sure to come down to the Railway Club Tuesday nights until the final showdown on December 10th. First place gets the high honor of being sacrificed on Grouse Mountain
to Satan, God of Darkness.
Plus, there's jokes for beer and all the shit talking of Ben Lai that you can handle. That's every Tuesday now until December 10th. See you there.
One campus, one station, over 40 live broadcasts. Tune in every weekend as CITR provides live coverage of UBC varsity sports. With over 40 live internet and radio broadcasts in men's and women's hockey, basketball, and volleyball, CITR is your voice for Thunderbird Athletics.
Takes on the University of Lethbridge in their first of two weekend games before the winter break.
How you feeling? Feel all right?
CITR presents DJing 101.9. We offer people a way to learn about the fun of mixing, sharing music, and throwing events. Our workshops and studio access is free for students and members. No experience or turntables are necessary. Workshops from 4 to 8 p.m. are on Tuesdays in 212A in the Student Union Building at UBC. For more information, visit us at citr.ca or follow at citrdj on Twitter.
Saturday, November 30th, it's Mint Records' Ridiculously Early Christmas Party at the Ukrainian Hall, featuring Jay Arner, Tough Age, Nardwar and the Evaporators, Rennie Wilson, The Ramblin' Ambassadors, Fake Tears, Sean Morasic Lives, and more. Tickets available at Red Cat Zulu or on brownpapertickets.com.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to citr.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today's Friday, the 29th of November. I'm Alex Sarah-Davis.
And I'm Tilly DeCalli. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is currently 5:12 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news, as well as news from around the world brought to you by Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News. All this, plus your weekend forecast brought to you by Environment Canada. Today is our last show of the season, and so we thought we'd prepare our listeners for the oncoming shopping season by giving many of our stories a holiday consumer spin. Today's top stories and segments are the fourth episode of In Their Shoes by Mormay, talking to students and staff about what they would do if they were in position to smoke marijuana legally and how that will commercialize on the drug change and their attitudes. Will they light up or butt out? As well, a follow-up interview on giving aid. Today's hosts, Morgan Yee and Alex Sarah Davis, will be speaking to Jan Ludert, a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science, and Dan Kim, the co-president of UBC 50K. On aid in light of Typhoon Haiyan and their thoughts on the Christmas push to give. And today's hot topic is, in the spirit of Christmas, the spirit of consumerism. We will also have a piece by contributor Josh Gabert Doyen on university collaboration with third parties and its effect on academic freedom, and Alistair Melling's commentary on the consumerization of political sports, professional sports.
This is Morgan. Hey, everybody. Up first, we're going to have myself and Alex talking to Jan and Dan on their views about giving aid. Hey, guys, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for having us on.
Oh, no problem. I'm just trying to see if Alex is in here. Al, you there?
Am I here?
No, you're going to have to come share with me, bud.
That's okay. All right, I'll just show it with Dan.
All right, so welcome to News 101. So I guess the first question would just be, not really a question. If you guys could introduce yourselves and sort of what your stance is generally on giving aid. Dan, if you want to go first.
My name is Dan Kim. So for us, for my stance on giving aid is, especially during Christmas times, I think it's absolutely crucial because, you know, there's different families out there who are suffering from, you know, from this disaster. And I think that, you know, it's a time of giving, and, you know, so it would be a great way, I guess, to, promote.
Yeah, no worries.
Since it's a time of giving, it's a great way to promote the idea of giving aid, especially near Christmas time. There's usually, like, a heavy push towards giving aid during Christmas time, and oftentimes it's because people are in that giving mood, I guess.
Right.
And I feel like, if you're going to give, you know, instead of giving gifts, I feel like it's important to give to people who actually need it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that would be, like, the true meaning of Christmas.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Jan?
Oh, yeah. Hi. So I'm Jan Ludert, and I'm currently doing my work in international politics, focusing on sovereignty and non-state actors using the United Nations. But my background actually stems from working in international development. I spent 2.5 years working in Botswana for local NGOs. So not only do I bring a perspective on the practicalities and the practitioners of aid, but also now with a few years of theoretical thinking, I'm very glad that we can discuss these notions, especially in light of Christmas and people are willing to put an extra dollar out there. But obviously, as we've seen from the news about the typhoon and the aid response, it was initially rather slow, which is unusual, but perhaps has to do with the timing itself and also with domestic issues that maybe make the U.S. citizens and Canadian citizens less likely to put that extra money into a place that's perhaps too far away from the purview.
Right, Al, if you want to weigh in on this as well, and quick introduction.
Sure, Alexander Sarah Davis here. We were having some technical difficulties with the microphones, unfortunately. But I'm here now, and one question that I have for the two of you is how you feel Canada and how you feel, you know, Canadians have reacted to Hurricane Haiyan, and if that reaction has been appropriate.
Just So, one thing that I think is quite interesting is I've been reading up on the response a little bit. The Canadian government has pledged that it would give a dollar for each dollar that is being donated by individuals or private organizations. So, which is actually quite an interesting approach, because it seems to indicate that governments are only willing to support aid efforts if they are pledged in due kind by individuals. So this actually points to a rather liberal approach to aid in the 21st century. And it's more or less a push away from the traditional bilateral aid distribution that we had seen in the past. So that's one of the interesting aspects which I think we can observe. And the other one is obviously because of there are many Filipino immigrants living in Canada. So the ways that diasporas are actually now committing to aid efforts in the way that they bring back money into their home country through what we call remittances is another interesting aspect which is worthwhile focusing on. And if I understand correctly, you had someone on last week from the communities of Filipino communities.
Yes, we had Liza and Francis who are running a night with the Philippines.
Yeah, so I think that's very interesting to just follow up how aid really sometimes gets an extra push if there is enough of a critical mass of the diaspora within Canada. And so I think that's an interesting aspect as well.
For listeners who don't know what diaspora are, could you give a quick definition?
Oh, so the diaspora is people living away from their home country, whether they chose to by themselves or whether it's due to, you know, exile. They're being exiled for one reason or the other, politically, economically.
Okay. Now, Dan, I know you're involved with UBC 50K. As we mentioned before, you're the co-president of that organization. Can you explain a little bit about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, actually, I'm the co-president of UBC Dollar Project.
Oh, UBC Dollar Project, sorry.
Yeah. And we collaborated with the FSA, the Filipino Student Association, the SUS, and the Global Lounge, and a bunch of other clubs to organize the UBC 50K.
There we go.
And what we did was we based this idea on, like, if everyone on campus, there's around like approximately 50,000 students on campus, if everyone just donates just $1, then it will add up to a substantial $50,000. And like he just said, the government is willing to match dollar for dollar, mm-hmm, to a total of potential $100,000. So what we did was we did like a DIY, do-it-yourself campaign kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There was a tutorial. Not really a tutorial, but it's basically like I just took some pictures of how to make a container by yourself and register your container, and then you can start collecting money. And yeah, and one thing I would like to add is like he did bring up an interesting topic about how the government's collecting monetary donations, right? Mm-hmm. And recently, if you've heard, there's been a lot of corruption news in the Philippines prior to the actual typhoon,
right?
And maybe one way, one reason why the Canadian government might have actually promoted this idea of matching dollar for dollar is because maybe they might have wanted to avoid like the transparency of funds, mm-hmm, like going directly towards the Philippines,
right?
So the Filipino government actually sent out their bank accounts abroad for people to donate to, but then as soon as that happened, the Canadian government actually promoted that, they're going to match dollar for dollar. And that could have been an attempt to avoid,
funneling funds directly into the government.
Into the government. And, you know, people wouldn't know if it would go directly towards the Philippines. And for
and like aid relief.
Yeah, aid relief.
Okay. Cool. So when we're looking at aid and different aid models, I know last week we talked to we talked to Rose Charities, and their model is really it's really grassroots. It's working with a lot of organizations who are already on the ground, as opposed to having to send teams over. Jan, can you speak to that at all? Like, whether you think that is an effective way to give aid, or whether, you know, giving just primarily monetary funds and sending, you know, Western teams over.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, obviously, in a humanitarian disaster, primarily usually what's important is a direct help that usually is quite technical. You know, that comes with food, with water. So in that sense, money can't buy it all, because sometimes the expertise of particular organizations is really at stake. You know, governments that send over military that helps with rebuilding bridges and, you know, just getting the country back onto its feet and making aid delivery possible. So in that sense, the traditional ways that aid has been delivered by the organizations that have that technical capacity is still very crucial. Now, I mean, I very much applaud the funding that you guys are in involved in. So all I can say is, I mean, next week is the last week of class. So all of you go out there in your last week in school and just give a dollar here and there, and then just get in touch with the dollar project, because I think it's a worthwhile way of trying to now get in this kind of second phase the aid that's needed in these types of situations such as we're having in the Philippines. Now, there's obviously also an important distinction that we have to make between disaster relief, that is that technical side, and then development. And oftentimes these two are conflated and they do follow up on each other. So we have to be careful in the way that we look at delivery and in what is it for. And so people that are concerned about corruption and these matters, it's just crucial that you go on the website, check out the organization, what are their track records, have they been able to follow through on the promise that they have made. And that is just something that you as a potential donor have to keep in mind. But we can never really mitigate against potential corruption. It's always going to be a problem.
Right. Alex?
Yeah, I was going to ask. So you see, do you see an important distinction between development and foreign aid? Because I know that the Conservative government here in Canada has often framed their giving of foreign aid as an attempt to help these countries develop.
Yeah, I've been working on a project where I'm actually comparing Canada's aid response to Haiti and the Kashmir earthquakes that we've had in recent years to the response that Cuba had. And one thing that the findings have so far indicate is that Canada follows what I would call a more liberal, solidarist approach. And that approach means that it's willing to support and help on a short-term basis with the type of technical needs that a country or that people on the ground really need at a given point, but then tends to withdraw and due to its government structures will actually begin delivering development aid in a kind of a second wave. And here the problem that we have, that we face, is what we call tied aid. That is that aid is given on the basis that it, in one way or the other, supports the donor's economy, right, whether it is through the resources that are spent, the cars that are bought, the computers that are used, the staff that's being paid. Cuba, on the other hand, has a much different approach. Not only do they set up small hospitals and send doctors so that it's much more human-centered and not so technical. And they set up these hospitals to first deliver short-term relief, and then they move into training nurses, keeping those structures intact. So in that sense, that switch between relief and development is actually overcome. And the indicators show that Cuban disaster relief and long-term involvement actually has better health outcomes. This is something that the Canadian government could take on, but the agendas are different. So it's a critique that I would have. However, both approaches in the end are important. And we have to recognize the national interests of any given donor state, and their purposes and objectives of delivering aid often have to do with the political environment in which they are shaped.
Well, in light of that, Dan, do you feel that, because when Jan's talking about, you know, development and long-term aid, do you have any concerns that in really fostering a sense of giving right around Christmas time that people will forget that aid is needed throughout the year. So just like that, perhaps like giving really this big push right around Christmas to give aid, do you feel that that may discourage people from giving aid later in the year because they feel like they've already done their bit?
Throughout the year, other than Christmas.
Yeah.
That's actually a good point. That's a possibility because, people aren't expected to donate like constantly, every month or so. Whatever donation they make, you know, it matters. And I guess, donating just throughout Christmas, the media actually really pushes towards collecting funds near Christmas time for obvious reasons. I think that's a good point it might actually discourage some people to stop fundraising throughout the year other than Christmas.
Are there other things that students can do to stay involved? Like if they are really keen on getting involved in foreign aid, are there other things that they can keep doing?
Yeah, there's always community-based fundraisers, like the ones we're doing right now. Of course, in a community setting where we keep, there's a group of people who keep promoting these kind of donations and fundraisers. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you're involved and if you're in the UBC community, you'll probably see us a lot more throughout the year. Yeah, other than that, like immersing yourself in those kind of communities is a really good way to be involved. I think you actually have to actively seek out to support, or else you know you don't really. If you stop seeing them, seeing these kind of fundraisers throughout campus or throughout your everyday lives, then you probably tend to forget it later in the future.
I think we're gonna wrap up now. Unless Al, you have anything else? Do you guys have any final comments on, you know, giving aid in general or specifically the events in the Philippines?
So really, support the project that's going on at UBC. I would really hope that some of you will take the plunge and make a contribution and keep yourself informed. Read the news and be critical of what money can buy. You know, good intentions are not always clear on the morality and the ethics that are involved. So money will not buy it all, but the good intentions may help.
Okay.
Also, if people are worried about, you know, where their money's going, there's a way to track the money, and we're going to, as soon as we finish donating to the Canadian Red Cross, we're going to make sure everyone can see where all the money went and what it went towards.
Okay. Awesome. Thing. And then we'll put up that information on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys both very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick PSA break, and then we will be right back with more News 101.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Training Hall, featuring Jay Arner, Tough Age, Nardwar and the Evaporators, Rennie Wilson, The Ramble Ambassadors, Fake Tears, Sean Morasic Lives, and more. Tickets available at Red Cat Zulu or on brownpapertickets.com.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is what will you do? Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Welcome to the last hot topic of the year, everyone. As December draws near and everyone gets hyped for the holidays.
That was just a little taste of Mormay's episode 4 of In Their Shoes, where she will be talking to students and staff about what they would do if they were in position to smoke marijuana legally. Yeah, so here it is.
Hello and welcome to the 4th episode of In Their Shoes. My name is Mormay Zanke, and each week I ask students on the UBC campus, if you were a celebrity or political figure, what would you do in their shoes? This week I'm asking students if they were a citizen in a state or province or any place that legalized marijuana, would their opinion of smoking it change? This topic has popped up in the news lately with the legalization in Washington and Colorado in the states, as well as Justin Trudeau's statement that he's smoked marijuana and that he would be pro-legalization of it. The topic is still very ambiguous, however. Nobody really knows what its effects are. It's been conjectured that it is unharmful. However, there are some scientists out there saying otherwise. It's a very ambiguous field. So with that in mind, thinking about this question, we definitely need to look at it objectively, listen to the opinions that are shared, respect them, whatever they may be, and know that this is a personal question, and nobody should be judged or held very accountable for the answers that are shared here. This is a safe space, and we're not going to chase anyone down based on how they feel about a topic that is very controversial in the world right now. Some people are very against it, and some people are pro-legalization. So let's listen to a few opinions, first from Vanessa and then from Adrian.
So my name's Vanessa. I personally have never tried smoking marijuana. I don't like smoking at all. I also don't smoke tobacco. So even if it was legalized, such as tobacco, which is also legalized, I wouldn't change my opinion on smoking in general, and I wouldn't smoke either.
My name is Adrian. I'm a first-year science student. I already believe that marijuana should be legalized. I think it would bring a lot of revenue for the government, and that it isn't a very harmful substance in itself to begin with medical marijuana programs. So I guess my opinion wouldn't change. Like, I already think it should be legal, so it should stay legal.
So again, two very diverse opinions that obviously clash. Vanessa was completely against it. Adrian was for it. We can see their views respectively. Why they believe them is their own personal thing, and I respect them for sharing that with me, and I really appreciate hearing from them. So those were two people whose opinion would not change just because their core belief inherently was that they either were for it or against it, and they believed that wholly, and legalization wouldn't really matter to them because they're who they are, and they don't need the laws to change that. But our next two people feel like their opinion would change if it was legalized.
I think I would, actually, because my opinion about marijuana is like that I shouldn't smoke it because it's illegal. But then if it's legal, I think my opinion will change a little bit.
So my name is Victor Giberti. I think that in that situation, my view of smoking marijuana would change because it is inherently linked with criminality because it's something illegal. And it's a bit like with the same with alcohol. So people see alcohol differently just because it's legal. So if smoking marijuana became legal, my view of it would definitely change.
I really like what Victor had to say about how it's inherently linked to criminality. And that would change his opinion just if it was legalized, because then it wouldn't be, you know, breaking the law, which it's probably a good thing not to break the law. So I understand definitely where his opinion is coming from. I think a lot of people identify with his opinion just from the people that I've spoken with. The stigma against a crime is very big, and that's powerful. And that really hits home with a lot of people, because breaking the law correlates directly for people as an inherently wrong thing that they should not do at all. So it makes sense that if it was legalized, more people would be open to it and more willing to try it. To wrap this question up, we have two more opinions from Kavoni and Bethany.
Hi everyone, I'm Kavoni. I'm from Jamaica. So honestly, I don't smoke marijuana, disclaimer, but my opinion on smoking marijuana, I guess maybe because I'm where I'm from, is not necessarily, I don't really have a negative view to it, you know? So I don't really necessarily view it as something negative. I don't view it as something positive, but honestly, like, I view smoking tobacco, like, I look down on smoking tobacco more than I look down on smoking marijuana. So if they were to legalize marijuana, then I wouldn't necessarily view it any differently.
My name is Bethany Terracina, and my opinion would not be changed in a place that legalizes marijuana if it were to be legalized.
Why is that?
I guess it's a personal choice. Whether it's legalized or not shouldn't change your opinion on, whether it's... It's personal choice, so.
So first, let's dissect what Kavoni had to say. I really think she had some good points in her response. She said that it wasn't negative, and she said it wasn't positive either. So she took more of a neutral stance, and she said she wouldn't view it any differently. It was a pretty chill answer. I liked what she said. It seemed to me like she almost felt how Bethany felt, that it was a personal choice, that however you feel about it, it should be up to you, and it should be, you know, how you personally feel about it. Bethany pretty much summed it up. It's a personal choice. Everyone has their own opinion. It's a sensitive topic, that's for sure. And I think that's how we should all approach it. Cautiously aware of how people have strong feelings about it. And just with the idea that there is no wrong opinion in this type of question. Just because there's such an array of opinions and of viewpoints, it doesn't really matter what your view is as long as you respect how other people feel about it and how you react to, you know, the world around you and the changes that could occur. This topic, there were so many different responses. It just goes to show how ambiguous, you know, the topic of weed is. Just weed in and of itself is so ambiguous and unclear. We don't know what its effects are 100%. We don't know, you know, what the consequences of its legalization would be, you know, until we implemented it. It's very hard to rationalize, and I think everyone I interviewed today did a really good job of rationalizing it in their head, and it was just a great question to ask for our final session before the winter break. I will see you guys after the break, and thanks so much for tuning in. See you next time.
And thank you to Mormay for that segment. Next up is Josh's discussion of academic freedom.
Last Wednesday, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, or CAUT, released a report on academic freedom and the influence of outside money on academia. James Turk is the executive director of the CAUT. He was reached by phone to talk about the report and its findings.
The first thing we found is that all the agreements of collaborations, or almost all of them, between universities and third parties, were secret documents, not available to students or faculty or the public. So we had to spend the better part of 2 years getting the agreements so we could analyze to see when the university entered into a partnership, did it protect those things that make the university unique? By that I mean academic freedom for the faculty and researchers, the right of the researchers to publish what they find, whether or not the partner is happy with the findings, whether or not the decisions of which projects to fund were made by peer review rather than by some body in which the private interests determine who gets funded, and so forth. And so we were able to get documentation on 12 major collaborations across the country, and the great majority of them, the universities absolutely failed to protect the integrity of their institutions.
The report that Executive Director James Turk was talking about there is entitled Open for Business, On What Terms? And focused on corporate influence in universities and research. The report was conceived out of a similar study done in the United States, which revealed a lack of protection for academic freedom in collaborations between universities and third parties. Two projects between UBC and outside parties were examined in the CAUT study. Here's Turk again on those projects.
We did look at two at UBC. One was called the Mineral Deposit Research Unit, which is a complex collaboration between UBC and a number of mining companies. And different ones can be partners in different years. And by and large, that agreement is one of the ones that's basically okay. In that agreement, most of the rights that any university faculty member would expect, and which are the kinds of rights that distinguished research in universities from elsewhere, were protected. The second UBC collaboration is called the Vancouver Prostate Center, and that's a collaboration between the university, Pfizer, and the British Columbia Cancer Agency. That one, the university really dropped the ball in our view. The agreement is silent on academic freedom. The decision about which research gets funded is made by a research committee in which each of the partners has a vote, and all the decisions have to be unanimous. So effectively, Pfizer has veto power. And it says that in the event that the parties can't agree, it goes to the management of the parties and then can go to the courts, which means that if Pfizer doesn't like somebody's research, they can effectively, it can block it, and then it could take years in courts to sort it out. One of the things that we did is we developed guidelines for university collaborations. You know, basically, if a drug company issues a new drug and says, our scientists in our company did research and find this the greatest drug in the field, people look at it skeptically. If a group of medical researchers at UBC do research and publish in the New England Journal of Medicine and say, we've looked at antidepressants and this new drug by company X is really the best in the field, it's given credibility because there are certain things that are associated with research done in universities. That is, the researchers have academic freedom. There's peer review in deciding. They have the freedom to publish and so on. So there's credibility. And so when universities enter into agreements and don't insist upon those things that give it credibility, then the standard of the university becomes diminished, and the public will gradually lose trust in the institution, and it puts the academics and the program at risk because they don't have the protections that they should have.
The UBC projects investigated by the CAUT offer an interesting contrast. The Mineral Deposit Research Unit, in many respects, represents a positive collaboration between university and industry. The Vancouver Prostate Center, however, raises serious questions about the ability of a university to preserve its integrity in collaborations with third parties. Craig Hart, director of the Mineral Deposit Research Unit, believes that to a certain extent, collaborations between university and outside industry is necessary to make sure that a workforce is qualified for available work. I spoke to him at his MDRU office about the research unit, how it preserves academic freedom, and his reaction to the Open for Business report.
So in 1989, a bunch of industry guys from downtown were aware that there needed to be an increase in the amount of knowledge and research and training and education in that space of exploration, mineral exploration. And so they got together with NSERC and they put some money together that allowed this center to be created. Right. So at the time, they called it the Mineral Deposit Research Unit, and that's what we're still called today. And that happened 25 years ago, and at the time, it was sort of an experiment, and it's worked out pretty well, and so we've been able to persist over this 25-year period. So the goal really is to provide research that has an application to real-world decision-making, to train up highly educated graduate students so that they, when they go out into the world, they are people that can take over leadership positions. And the other thing is we provide training for the individuals who work in the companies who want to up their game.
Yeah.
So it's a partnership, right? Mm-hmm. It's a partnership between the industry and between the university. And so the university, or the industry puts in most of the money, and the university puts in most of the space and the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And we have a board of directors that is comprised of industry types and of university types, and we make decisions about the directions that we do put our research towards. Mm-hmm.
So do you guys like have special measures in place for academic freedom?
We have our own sort of internal operating code, if you call it that. But the one that is the most transparent and written down and obvious for us is UILO. Okay. That's the University Industry Liaison Office. So they're the brokers, essentially, between any funding that comes into the university for research from outside, any non-government funding. So if industry groups or associations or societies, you know, whether it's a cancer society or whoever, if they want to provide funding for some sort of research, then it has to go through this UILO group. And UILO have some very, very strong provisions about how and under what terms they will actually accept any money for research.
Okay.
And so for us, that's the biggest and most obvious filter that they provide. Yeah.
How do you feel about the report itself?
You know, like I say, if they just came and asked me for real information, I'd give them real information. So most of the information they had was somewhat misguided, and they misinterpreted it, and so they're going down a pathway that really isn't that appropriate, but you couldn't really see anything in there that was particularly negative, and it's because there is nothing negative, so even if you try to spin it, it doesn't really actually look that bad. Really what it does emphasize is that there's a partnership between industry and UBC that's actually working out pretty good because we've been doing this for 25 years.
The mineral deposit research unit aside, questions of academic freedom brought up by this report is relevant to UBC at this moment in time. Earlier this month, the Canadian International Institute for Extractive Industries and Development, based at UBC, released a list of strategic partners which will be offering support to the fledgling institute. The list is composed of more than 60 academic institutions, NGOs, governments, and companies which are helping to fund the institute. The institute is focused on providing expertise to developing countries in the field of resource extraction and governance in that sector. UBC is part of a coalition of three universities which won a grant from the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development to create the institute. The institute, however, has been receiving some scrutiny. Evyatar Ba, a member of the UBC Social Justice Center, recently wrote a report on the human rights and environmental abuses of some of the institute's strategic partners. The report was published by Not From My Campus, a website devoted to, quote, raising critical questions about the institute. How will these strategic partners be supporting the institute?
The institute claims that the strategic partners will complement and expand the expertise and experience of the coalition members to ensure that the institute can ably fulfill its mandate. I think it's questionable whether they will help fulfill the mandate, and one of the claimed values of the institute, for example, is accountability. And you have this law firm that is actually opposed to accountability for Canadian mining corporations abroad. Another problem, I think, is that these companies have a conflict of interest. If the company is going to promote social responsibility abroad, then these companies have a financial incentive to not cooperate.
How do you feel the CAUT report relates to your findings?
The leadership of the institute has claimed that the strategic partners are not going to affect the institute's workings, and that it will be completely independent. And I think the CAUT report, which reports on collaborations in Canadian universities, shows that oftentimes that isn't the case. There's no independence. So what we're asking for is, if the institute doesn't get rid of these partners, at least that it implements some sort of structural changes which will ensure that it's independent. So we don't really have enough information about what they will be involved with at this point, but I think it's important to question it.
This is Joshua Gabertuano reporting for CITR News.
Thank you, Josh. And up next, we have today's hot topic. Is the spirit of Christmas the spirit of consumerism? We are going to have to cut it a little short as we've got started later than normal, but you can access the whole file from our Facebook page.
Welcome to the last hot topic of the year, everyone. As December draws near and everyone gets hyped for the holidays, one can't help but wonder, what is the true spirit of Christmas?
My name's Jenna, I'm in first year and I'm in arts.
Okay, do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
Personally, I think yes. The perfect depiction of this is in Mariah Carey's / Justin Bieber's take on All I Want for Christmas Is You, and they're just shopping and buying so many toys and pieces of technology, and I just think it's absolutely vile. I think that that's completely taken away from what Christmas spirit should really be about, creating all this kind of consumerist views in the media and through music and just through everywhere in society is taking away from why we should be really celebrating it.
Do you think charity organizations are taking away from that spirit?
I think that charity organizations, obviously Christmas is all about giving, and charity is about giving to the less fortunate or animals or anything like that. Nevertheless, I kind of feel that charities, some of the bigger charities, are perhaps also jumping on the consumerist bandwagon. A lot of what we see through charities is done through advertisements. Charities do use spokespeople, celebrities, who are very like prominent figures in the consumerist world. So in that respect, I think it's a bit contradictory.
I'm Sally. I'm a third year science student.
All right. So do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
No, I don't. Well, personally, I believe in Christmas, like the Christian aspect of it, so...
Do you think gifts play a really big part in that as well?
They probably did when I was a little younger, but now I like to think I place a little less emphasis on materialism.
I'm Manu Bajwa, so I'm studying science and second year.
Do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
I don't know, I kind of, in some ways, yeah.
So what's the most important thing for you about Christmas?
I don't know, just getting together with family and stuff, I think. It's just, like, a good time of the year. Everyone's, like, happy and, well, shopping as well, so.
Are you planning to buy a lot of gifts this year?
Yeah, probably.
All right, thanks.
My name is Lana Newton, and my faculty is something I always forget, the ECPS. I'm in the Measurement Evaluation Research Methodology program for my Master's of Education.
Do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
Does consumerism have a spirit, I would ask, at all? Probably not. That's why it's so shitty. I mean, it sucks. So I would say no, because consumerism has no spirit or soul. Yeah.
Do you think gifts are a really big integral part of Christmas?
No, I hate spending a ton of money on gifts. I mean, my parents give me lots, and then there's some guilt associated with not giving them lots, but I'd rather just hang out.
What do you think is the most important part of Christmas?
Doing something interesting in the winter when it's cold and dark outside and boring. Yeah.
I think. My name is Emily. I'm in pharmacy. I'm in my third year.
Okay. So, I'm asking UBC students, do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
Yeah, I think so, to a degree. I think it can bring out the worst in people in that sense, and it can bring out the best in others if you're giving to good causes, like around the world or that sort of thing. But, yeah, I agree.
So, would you say that, like, gifts are one of the most integral parts of Christmas?
I think it depends on who you ask, to be honest. To me, it's not, but to some people, it can be.
So for you, what's the most important part of Christmas?
Well, I'm not from here, so it's nice to go home and see my family. It's really exciting.
Hi, my name is Peter Key. I am in first year, and I am in the Faculty of Arts.
So do you think that the spirit of Christmas is really the spirit of consumerism?
I do think that there is a greater emphasis on consumerism when it comes to Christmas. Like, there is, like, a greater, like, thinking of, like, oh my gosh, I have to buy all of this stuff for my friends and all that kind of stuff. So definitely there is an aspect of consumerism, but whether, like, the actual spirit of Christmas itself is consumerism, I don't necessarily think they coincide, because mainly the actual aspect of, or the actual, like, meaning behind Christmas is, well, in a secular context, would be all about, like, being with your friends, being with your family, being home together. And like what I've seen with a lot of other friends of mine is the fact that they are so excited to be back home, to be with their family and friends and stuff like that. So I don't think consumerism really, like, I see consumerism more as like a compliment towards that kind of meaning, but I don't think it actually is the meaning of Christmas. So that's kind of what I think.
Thank you to Christine for this season's last hot topic. And once again, you can hear the full piece on our Facebook page. Up next, we have Alice Dare with a critique on the commercialization of professional sports.
Okay, thank you very much, Alex. Very quickly, I personally come from a background of football or soccer from Europe. And that's probably much the only commercialized sport within Europe. All other sports, it's the professionalization of it. all the professionals, they have a part-time job. So, for example, I had two history teachers in my school who were professional fit rugby players, but were also obviously my full-time teacher for history. What the big thing actually made me realize about this whole commercialization of sports was when I came over to the Americas, where you have on Monday night football, you have Tuesday baseball, Wednesday the hockey games, Thursday night football. Every single day is devoted to some sort of sport, and then obviously the weekend is completely devoted to sport. So the issue I have here is just it's possible to watch watch TV and not see anything. I think it completely detaches people from the real world, because you have this, you would say, people who, they don't play the sports necessarily, they used to play the sports, and all they do is devote themselves to learning statistics, the names of the players, and learning about their lives. And the idea that we should pay people extortionate amounts of money, this happens in Europe as well, but coming here made me realize it, and then critique back. I'm not saying Europe is the same prospect, it's just here hockey, you have baseball, American football, and it's all, even golf, which is just a horrendous sport, even though it's Scottish. Not patriotic about that in any sense. You just hit a ball and walk after it. Serious issue with that sport. I think sports should be, the objective of them is to keep people fit, not to distract them from real life. So when you have the Monday night, so when you have the Super Bowl coming on, everyone forgets about anything else that's happening in the world, and everyone focuses upon going and watching the Super Bowl and knowing everything that's happened. I think there's a certain amount of community basis that comes from sports, and I agree with that. I played rugby until 15 and played cricket until I was 18. And the certain community base community around the sport, and I agreed with that. But the idea that someone should devote their lives entirely to sport and then have very little prospect of having, once they've physically deteriorated and they can't play the sport anymore, they have to rely on the money came from that, and obviously they haven't spent it well. Also, I disagree entirely with the fact that these players who get paid ridiculous amounts of money get away with, I mean, the raping of, I can't remember the topic of a specific case, but there was, I think it was a while ago, American footballers essentially raped a girl, and because they have the money, people like them for their personality, they seem to get away with it. It's entirely unfair that just because they play sports professionally, because they're physically better than, and you know, they've devoted their lives to this sport, that they should get away with these kind of things. What I really would like to see is just this decrease of the whole idea of, I think sports should become far more community-based and shouldn't be on TV and distract people from real-life issues. Now, we haven't got much time, but I would love to hear a little bit of your opinions. I haven't been comprehensive in my explanation, so, but I would love to hear of your opinions.
So I'm just curious. So is what you're critiquing then mostly the commercialization or the idolization of sports?
Well, the commercialization and idolization, they come very much hand in hand, where you see these people on TV. You don't get to know about their other lives, but you see them doing crazy moves and very impressive, and they do slow motion and everything. I think that idolizes those people. And just the fact that you can become entirely involved in something that that holds no value to human civilization, it doesn't develop, it doesn't forward us in any technological manner, I think that is an abhorrent thing that we have in society. And it's a commercialization entirely of sports. It should be for communities, it should be to keep people fit, and not for people to sit in front of the TV drinking beer and just cheering randomly. They don't, for no real reason, just, I support this thing, and then therefore I'm going to hate this other team just because I support this team.
And I would love to jump into there, but we are out of time for today's show.
So that's our program for today, folks. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next semester after the
next
new year.
Yeah, next year.
Woo! On Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for other editions of News 101. I've been Alex Sarah Davis.
He's been no longer.
I'm Talita Kelly. Today's show is produced by
Morgan Yee.
From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
And stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Stressful time of year, which means it's more important than ever to take good care of yourself. Take this moment to feel good. Follow along with this mini meditation and reduce stress quickly. Breathe in and hold for 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale slowly. Breathe in once more and hold for 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale slowly. Visit students.ubc.ca/feelgood for other ways to live well, feel good, and achieve success.
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
Is everybody awake?